Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today is July 24th. What you're going to hear is a conversation that I had actually a couple weeks ago with a wonderful young man named Jeff Maxim, who is actually hoping to do an internship with School Sucks Project. Sometime in the not too distant future, we will explain all that in the conversation. He was in the studio with me for this show. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation, and I really apologize about the lack of content recently. There's a lot going on, and I hope you'll just bear with me a little bit longer. We do have the concluding installment in that series, How the Truth Became Illegal, and there's actually a lot more to my conversation with Jeff that will be available in the AV Club, and there'll be video of this on the site as well. So I hope you're enjoying your summer, and I hope to be back full-time sooner than later, but there's definitely stuff in the works. So thanks for listening. Thanks for your patience, and I'll talk to you again soon. Hey everybody, and welcome to the School Sucks Live Show for July 9th, 2013. I am Brett, and in the studio with me tonight is Jeff.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming all the way to New Hampshire from California. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a 15-year-old philosopher. I run a blog called Skeptical Youth. It's on Tumblr and Facebook. And also, I'll be doing a session at the Rethinking Everything conference in Texas in August about becoming unschooled and my experience with unschooling.
So you actually are just down here in Manchester, New Hampshire, staying with me for a couple of days. And before that, you were up with Dana Martin in the northern part of New Hampshire.
Yep.
And you were there for what, about a couple weeks?
2 weeks, yeah.
And before that, we were all together at Porkfest.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
That was a lot of fun.
My first Porkfest.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think you'll go back?
Definitely, if I can get out there.
Sure. So after this, you're going back to California, and here's what people should know. We've been talking now for a little over a month about you possibly doing an internship with School Sucks in the winter.
Yeah.
And that'll be really cool because I have a lot of things that, you know, I dream of doing, but I lack the time, organization, and help.
Yeah.
So that's where you come in.
Yep.
And that'll be very cool. And we're going to, you know, try to really push things forward on YouTube, which you have experience. You also used to work for Adam Kokesh.
Yep.
Adam versus the Man, his operation. So you'll probably be, you know, doing some stuff similar to that, but also some new stuff as well. And of course, you know, we have almost 5 months until we're supposed to start this, so you might have a whole new range of interests that you want to pursue here, and you certainly will have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of. I mean, it's going to be a lot of fun.
I think so too. I think it will be. And we had a great day yesterday because we went out to see a friend of ours, another Free Stater who lives up in the wilderness. Which is only, interestingly, funny thing about New Hampshire, we're right here smack dab in the middle of a city.
Mm-hmm.
But we drove for just a little more than 20 minutes. We were in the middle of nowhere.
Yep.
On a farm.
Mm-hmm.
And you might be working with me and living on this little farm and being a farmhand at the same time.
Yeah.
Which will give you quite a bit of very diverse experience.
Yep. A lot of things to think about.
Yeah, I was so impressed. Our friend Brian, who's actually a supporter of School Sucks, and he's one of my trusted advisors for School Sucks, offered Jeff this opportunity to come and fill this vacancy that he's had for some time as a farmhand. So he's got chickens, and he's doing, what did he call it, hula culture?
Yeah.
Which I was totally unfamiliar with, but it was so fast, and we saw so much stuff. He's actually going to, I'm going to invite him on the show, I should say, for a series that we were talking about called Stuff They Won't Teach You in School.
Yeah.
Which mostly has to do with, you know, being happy, being independent, self-sufficient, making money, like all things that you won't learn in school.
Yeah.
That will be an upcoming series on School Sucks. And hopefully Brian will, maybe I can go back out there and get like a video tour
of his operation, because beautiful gardens, fruit trees. He had a shooting range. He was digging ponds. It is just amazing. Or digging holes, we should say.
Yeah,
we shouldn't call them
yes.
ponds.
Holes with water would be the technical term.
Right, right. Very impressive operation. I learned a lot.
Me too.
I've been out to his house several times. I had no idea so much stuff was going on there. And you're going to get a chance to be a part of that and a part of this. So that'll be exciting times.
It will be. It'll be a lot of fun.
And what do you think you're going to do in the meantime? Because that is like 5 months away. Yeah.
I don't know. Looking at a lot of stuff. I mean, hopefully trying to get that internship. I mean, well, not really internship slash mentorship with that animation studio. Continue writing, stuff like that. Hopefully writing for other blogs. Just a lot of stuff. I'm reading, of course, continuing to learn. There's a lot of cool stuff.
So then we're going to talk about today, and then we'll get into our topic for the show. Because I really teased it. I don't think anyone saw it on Facebook, which might be a good thing. But I teased it as which had a greater impact on society or on full, I guess, and that would include, well, let's just call it society, The Matrix or Atlas Shrugged? It's an interesting question when you start to think about it. Because I think first people say, oh, Atlas Shrugged. Grow up, Brett. But did it really? And we're going to talk about that. But first, and if you have, you know, anything to offer us or anything to add, 843, join SSP. You can Skype in School Sucks Live. I'm looking at Skype right now, so it's open. You know, sometimes I tell people to call. I get angry that no one calls. And people then point out to me that I never open Skype. It's open. We're ready. You know, you can call in at any time.
Hopefully we can have some people on tonight. That'd be a lot of fun.
That would be a lot of fun. Call in and talk about any educational topic that you want.
Anything interesting.
I can fix it in post-production, okay? I can make it all make sense in post. So if the mood strikes, just pick up that phone and call. But anyway, today we went to the ocean.
Yep.
Now, this was your first trip to the Atlantic. You've been to the Pacific because you live in California.
It was a lot of fun, though. A lot of thought-provoking stuff.
We looked at rocks.
Yeah.
We talked about rocks. We talked about how did this beach get to be – because the beach we were at – I mean, there's about 20 miles of coast in New Hampshire, but the beach we were at had, like, all of these boulders holding back this wall, kind of like a
smaller rocks.
I was really baffled by how this came to be.
Yeah.
So we collected rocks, we stacked rocks, we broke some rocks.
We skipped rocks.
We skipped rocks. We talked about rocks.
That was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of looking at the different rocks, the different colors, how they were shaped. Some were rocks inside of rocks.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That was interesting when we started breaking them apart. Now, here's the thing. You like look at a rock and you say, well, there's nothing I can do about that. You know, well, here's a tip. Take a rock and throw it against another rock. If it's big enough, if the other rock is hard enough and your rock is big enough, your rock will break. We broke rocks in half. We looked inside. It was wonderful. Very interesting. Did anything else? I chased a seagull for a while.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I also set up that little, there was all these holes that were in these rocks, and there was this big, like, long piece of wood. And so I stuck it in the hole, and then I found this.
It was like driftwood. It seemed like it had been in the water for a while.
But it was more just like it was actually a tree. It wasn't too, like.
Yeah, it was like a tree.
It was very strange.
That had been worn down by being in the water.
Yeah. But it was still not like driftwood. It's like driftwood usually just breaks apart very easily. This was still very strong. Mm. But then there was a piece of driftwood, so I put that up on a on the other rock, and then I got some, and I kind of decorated it with some, what would it be? It was like, I guess, trap, but rope, just rope that kind of floated up on the beach and made a little, I guess, art display for everybody.
I wish we had some better excavating equipment because it's fun to dig at the beach.
It was. We should have got those plastic shovels.
Yeah, or a metal detector.
Yeah, that would have been really cool. That would have gone off like all the time because of all the rocks.
Yeah, there's probably some guy there at 6 metal detecting all the good stuff.
Yeah, that's
true. You know, you got to get there. Now, today, it would have been great to go because, like, I realize in California, and this is a fact that I've known for a long time, and I'm not going to blow anyone's mind with this, the sun sets over the Pacific Ocean, right? So every night, people, if they're, you know, close enough to the coast or they have a good view of the coast, they get to see these beautiful sun over the water kind of scenes.
Yeah.
But in New Hampshire, you got to be up at like 5 to experience that.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, if you're up by like 7, you can still kind of get the general idea, but it's not as beautiful. A sunrise is not as beautiful as a sunset. But yeah, you can't beat a good sunset.
Yep.
Sunrise doesn't beat it, I'll tell you that. So we had a good day. And here we are doing a show.
Mm-hmm.
And let me give you the chat. So
I was actually just about to ask you that, but I forgot.
Someone asked, did you find what beach did you go to? Well, we drove pretty much the whole length of the Atlantic coast. Okay, now I can't see that at all, so I'm going to rely on you. So if you see anything interesting or relevant to what we're talking about, if you have a comment that you would like read on the show, please type it in all caps. So last night, you got here yesterday, and last night after we spent a lot of time talking about the show and a bunch of other, you know, topics,
yeah,
we sat down in front of the old TV because Jeff told me that he had never seen the movie The Matrix. A movie almost the same age as you.
Yep.
A movie that was certainly went into production before you were born.
I'm 1 year older, right?
You are 1 year older than the release of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, first of all, what did you think?
I thought it was pretty interesting. I really liked it. I mean, some of it was, I mean, maybe I could disagree with, or I mean, not disagree. Well, yeah, disagree, but also was kind of bland and like, just like action-y kind of fights. But still, I felt it was like, thought-provoking, and you could kind of critique it where, I mean, and like study it and learn from it, not where other movies it's kind of just bland and just it's just constant, so it doesn't really mean anything. Mm-hmm. At least there it was in a mix of stuff.
It is The Matrix does kind of hit you over the head with this movie means something.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But as I watched it again, I probably hadn't sat and watched the whole movie in like 8 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really seem like it has any kind of coherent philosophy.
Definitely.
In it. And I actually stopped. We were like 15 minutes into the movie and we talked about Plato and the allegory of the cave. Had you ever heard that story?
Yeah, fairly. I didn't look into much or I guess fully understand it till, I didn't even know fully what it was until you explained it to me then.
Yeah. So Plato, folks, if you're unfamiliar, in a lot of ways sucks, I think, in my opinion. Plato was probably the first rationalist philosopher and wrote this book, The Republic, which was like his utopian society. It's very grim, very dark.
Philosopher King,
he's talking about eugenics and not even positive eugenics. Like, yeah, if people are dim, you kill them, you know, or you kill their children. And the benevolent elite rule. And really poor treatment of the children that you don't kill. But what Plato does offer, in addition to basically being the reason that people today know about Socrates, because he didn't write anything down, is this allegory of the cave, which is a story that I think so many people who talk about, you know, free markets or voluntarism, libertarianism, peaceful parenting.
Philosophy in general.
Well, with maybe a few exceptions, right? People who want to show others the light.
Mm-hmm.
People who are interested in a pursuit of the truth and not just an acceptance of, you know, whatever is comfortable and whatever is conformist.
Yeah. Idle.
Yeah, exactly. So in the Allegory of the Cave, if anyone listening is unfamiliar, the reality that most people experience is in this cave and everyone is kind of chained facing a wall and there's a fire behind them and they see the shadows cast on the wall, which are completely being manipulated by people in the background as the only reality. And, you know, some people just accept it blindly. Some people are intrigued by what they see and have questions about it, but don't have the tools to get answers to those questions. And one person manages to break free and escape. And slowly they go out and experience the outside world, which is difficult at first. Very challenging because it's very bright out there compared to the cave. They want to come back and share with the people who are chained, staring at a friggin' wall in a cave, the vast wonder of the real world that's out there. And they're not into that. Plato says they're more likely to kill that person than see them as any kind of a savior.
Socrates.
Yeah, and that's most people who have studied the ancient Greek philosophers say that Plato's Allegory of the Cave is based on the story of Socrates, or the end of the story of Socrates.
I would even say, I mean, the Republic too effective too, because like having that elitist attitude of that we have to have these philosopher kings, because he saw Socrates, who was really knowledgeable, all this stuff, great philosopher, be killed by the people who didn't really understand this stuff at all. And so I think that partly was his elitist attitude, where he got that from too.
Mm.
I think Aristotle crystallized the idea that leaders could be effective if they were smart, intelligent people. And I think that's probably the worst thing you want, because then they just better control you and destroy your life for the most part.
Mm. Do you have that book?
Which one?
Ideas That Change the World. I want to, and I hope you'll bear with us, everyone. This is, kind of an informal show. This ain't Free Talk Live. I want to find the part where they talk about it. This is a really good – we were talking about this in the pre-show if you just joined us. This is a book I used to use on the show back in the old days, just as a quick reference, because it kind of distills these important broad philosophical subjects down to a page. So I used this when I was introducing like German idealism back in like the first 10 or 12 episodes. And, it's a good read. This Felipe Fernandez Armesto guy who wrote it is fair, I would say.
Well, his anarchism is totally horrible. I mean, this page about anarchism.
Why? Horrible. What did he say?
Well, first, he only described it as a left kind of, option. You have to be a lefty. And the fact that you have – I mean, I don't know if he said you have to, but he at least portrayed the stereotype that – violence against the state, throwing flaming mocktails against, the local city, town hall or whatever.
Yeah.
Quick question, though, about the cave. Was that a knock against the census? Because I'm not sure, but I think I remember hearing something about it just allowing your senses is the shadow. Is them seeing, the cave wall. And when you, free yourself from that, leave the cave?
That's actually, I think, insightful, because Plato was a rationalist where the trust is in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually, it's hard looking back and being introduced to philosophy through objectivism, where all of this, these old philosophical battles had kind of been settled.
Mm-hmm.
If you accept the tenets of objectivism, there was a real rift between rationalists and empiricists. So people who believe that, the reason was what you use in pursuit of the truth, while the empiricists said it's the senses.
Mm-hmm.
And, in the 18th century or the 19th century, excuse me, in Central Europe, the new consensus or the predominant philosophy in that era and that place, which became the philosophy of, not only most of Europe in the 20th century, but also the United States today, is, you can't really trust either. So, So objectivism said, no, we don't discard empiricism and reason. We embrace them both and we use them together.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think what you're saying makes sense, that Plato could have been saying that.
Yeah. I don't know. I just remember hearing something about that. I kind of think that would figure meet with Plato.
Right. We actually will take a break at some point, so we could get that question answered. Is there anything appearing in the chat that relates to that?
No, there's
people
nothing.
Still talking?
Oh,
about?
They just commented something.
Okay.
I love the internship idea. Lucky kiddo.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. Who said
thank
that? Oh, Sarah. Hello. Welcome back. Haven't seen you here in a while. Sarah is a super fan.
Oh, awesome.
That's what I call the most supportive people.
I'm glad you love the idea. Me too.
So that will be happening at the end of the year if you joined us late. But so there's a whole spread here about a couple paragraphs on philosopher kings from this book that I wanted to share. The idea of rule by an intellectual elite. Man, the lighting is bad in here. That's something we need to fix. No method of choosing rulers was proof against abuse. In 4th century BC Athens, Plato thought he could devise a system so perfect that society could rely on a benevolent ruling class. Among philosophers, Plato was surely the best ever writer and perhaps the greatest ever philosopher. He was, however, a member of an Athenian brat pack of rich, well-educated intellectuals who resented democracy and felt qualified for power. When he wrote his prescriptions for the ideal state and the republic, they came out harsh, reactionary, and illiberal. Illiberal in this case, meaning not free, if today's definition of liberal might lead to some confusion. The many objectionable features, censorship, repression, militarism, regimentation, extreme communism and collectivism, eugenics, austerity, rigid class structure, active deception of the people by the state, all had a baneful influence. The key idea, however, is that all political power should be concentrated into a self-electing class of philosopher rulers called guardians. Their qualification for office would be intellectual superiority, guaranteed by a mixture of heredity and education, which would make them selfless in their private lives and godlike in their ability to see what was good for the citizens. So this repellent system would conform to Plato's declared, quote, objective in the construction of the state, the greatest happiness of the whole and not of any one class, unquote. Plato wrote so brilliantly and so persuasively that this reasoning has continued to appeal to state builders ever since. His guardians are the inspiration for the intellectual ancestors, of the elites, aristocracies, party apparatchiks, and self-appointed supermen whose justification for tyrannizing others has always been that they know best.
Hmm.
Well, it certainly translates into the family as well.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, in Plato's Republic, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure there was no family. I mean, there was no family. Every kid or something would be son, and every adult male would be father. And kind of the really, I guess, what you would call socialization of the family?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in communism or extreme collectivism, you can't have any competing hierarchical structures, right? So yeah. The family is a place – and I mean, I guess that would be – it would ultimately be true in fascism too, is that you can't have competing loyalties to the state. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there were ways throughout, the 2300 or almost 2400 years that followed since Plato wrote that for people to kind of position themselves into being, if I got here, I'm obviously a smart guy. Went to Yale. I'm in Congress. I run a corporation. I'm on TV. You know, there's a lot of things have become unfortunately synonymous with being really smart, but seldom are they, seeming to be true when it comes to real, like, reason and philosophical soundness.
Yeah.
So that is certainly a very dangerous template if you don't unfortunately, Plato was before Lord Acton said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. So we'd love to hear your thoughts if you have anything to contribute. 843, join SSP, Skype in School Sucks Live. If you're shy, I understand. You can also just contribute anonymously, in our chat. You can have a login name by logging into Ustream where we can kind of know who you are. At least we have something to call you. Or you can also just chat anonymously with a number, a Ustreamer number, like that George Lucas movie from the early 70s. So we were talking about The Matrix. We went off track there, which was fine.
On a bit of a tangent.
Yeah, about Plato's cave, the allegory of the cave, which seems to – like the person who formulated the idea for that movie was at least aware of that story. Mm-hmm. I think it would be safe to say. But The Matrix doesn't really provide any coherent philosophy. It's mm-hmm. not even consistently anti-authoritarian.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Because, like, yes, you're freeing your mind from convention and the status quo and the establishment, or as people more oriented towards the left have kind of – it's not the government that is the matrix. It's the corporations. And the truth is it's probably a combination of both if it's what, is supposed to be represented in the real world. But there's also kind of another authoritarianism in it. Isn't there?
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact, the article, article, and then also Morpheus?
Yep.
Yeah. Both of them, how they just accept, it's kind of just a philosopher king kind of thing. Again, like these intellectual, authoritarians like control and just give orders to everybody else.
Yeah. But it's kind of like, it's even a little bit worse than that, I think, because you have the Oracle, who is like a mystical being. I have to apologize. And if anyone wants to straighten this out, please straighten this out. Cause I've seen The Matrix like a handful of times, and I saw the sequels like kind of paying attention to them, once or twice, because the sequels to The Matrix are really like when you watch The Matrix and you say, oh, that line was kind of dumb, or that didn't really make any sense, or boy, they're really, you know, overdoing it here with the concrete being pulverized by bullets in slow motion while techno music plays in the background. The sequels are just all like that, right? It's like they took the things that annoyed me most about the first movie and they stretched them out over, 4 hours, for two other movies that were shot at the same time and might have some redeeming qualities. Certainly they are special effects masterpieces, but really people do not regard them nearly as highly as the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I should look at them again, and maybe all three movies together do present a very coherent and important story.
I never seen the other two, so I can't say at all.
Yeah. But I didn't really enjoy them. I thought they were too confusing and garbled and less clear than the first movie. And the first movie had some, even though the first movie I think is a masterpiece and it's a groundbreaking film, it is a little bit incoherent in some parts.
Yeah.
So there's this mystical authoritarianism, like and that's not a worship of the Oracle, but this deference to, you know, like always like, what does, you know, the Oracle knows, that kind of thing. And Morpheus, and this is really exaggerated even further in the other two films, is kind of like a military authoritarianism where people will sacrifice to save the humans.
Not just military, I would say father type, father authoritarian figure. And I think this is this is not just like theory. What's the guy's name? The guy who was born in the real world? The brother, one of the brothers, the younger
Tank
one.
Tank and Dozer.
Yeah, Tank. He even says, he goes, you are not just a leader, but you were our father.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it is just implicitly right there.
He could be their father. I don't know.
Well, I didn't mean that. I meant, but that is true. But I didn't mean that like in a strict biological sense, but more in the, I guess, psychological sense.
Right. So what does that say to you? Or how did that... That rub you the wrong way?
It doesn't rub me a long way, but it's just very interesting. Into the mind of the creator of the piece of art, you know, the Matrix, and what he was thinking. What I would say his unconscious was expressing.
Right. Yeah. The other thing too is it's not like it's unanimous among the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar that like, oh well, we owe it to Morpheus to be obedient to him in this quest or this project that is never fully explained to us. And it's a lot of like vague talk about being the one, the one what. I had, you know, a vision, a lot of talk about believe. So there's some things that are troubling about that. But they don't, because it's Cypher, right? The Joe Pantoliano, who some of you might remember from Goonies or The Sopranos, great actor. The bald guy, who kind of turns on them and makes a deal with the machine or the Matrix itself, or the agents as they're represented in the artificial world of the Matrix, to originally give the code to the Zion mainframe, but then to give up Morpheus essentially.
Yeah.
And maybe rationalizes that by saying, oh, he tricked us, he didn't tell us what he was doing. So not everybody is fully grateful for the experience of, as he says at that dinner, like, this is, I'm eating steak. Yum, yum, yum. I don't care if it's real or not. Ignorance is bliss. So it pulling somebody out of that world and showing them how things really are as you ride in sewage tunnels in a crappy old ship eating slop.
constantly about to be killed by those like robots that are sent after them every once in a while.
It's an interesting metaphor, isn't it? I think for maybe, or at least how I interpret it as kind of the responsibility that you have when to other people's, or maybe not a responsibility, but the awareness that you need to have of other people's emotions. Like what you're doing to me right now when you talk about Christianity, mm-hmm. or you talk about conservatism, or you talk about liberalism, or you talk about America, the way you talk about it is kind of like pulling me out of pulling a bunch of plugs out of me, putting me in a smelly old ship and making me be chased by robots through sewer tunnels emotionally. So if that was the waking up process involves all of these hardships, that I think that kind of represents maybe some of the turmoil that people feel when they're put through that by somebody like Morpheus, who's, you know, trying to show people the truth.
And maybe, I mean, like the agents who are nowhere and everywhere in the, I guess with the, you know, the fake world, which is like, you know, they can manipulate it all and that kind of stuff. That's very interesting because that seems really, to describe the really reactive class, the ones who will actually like the kind of narcissists and people like that who are just attack like people who try to progress, you know, any ideas at all and try to, you know, build on that and hopefully discover something better. It seems, and you don't really, when you're looking out there and you're just talking to the random person, if you don't know if you're going to bring this up, if they're going to like react really badly, or they're going to react, you know, in a good way or a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe that could be a metaphor for that too, which is very interesting.
Because obviously, you know, spoiler alert, Neo does wind up reacting in a good way,
yeah.
rising to the challenge. So what's never really made clear, or if it's made clear, I think I missed it, the process of selection, like how do they find the people that they're going to liberate from the Matrix? Mm-hmm. Like we see in the fake world that they're inserted into it and they're watching Neo operate in that world to make this decision to take him out. But how do the other people get there?
Well, I mean, the constant theme throughout the whole film is you don't know and that's fine. Just follow orders. And there's this omnipresent kind of thing telling you to do this, so you better do this. And there's that kind of like theme is out through the whole film. And so I don't really think it's like, I mean, it really, I think it's, I mean, if I try to get an answer for that, it would just be Morpheus's, just him deciding. There's really no reason behind him or really anything he decides to do for the most part.
It's not clear to us, right? Like it's kind of like it's shrouded in mystery is the whole movie goes on. And when you first see the Matrix and like, you know, none of the stuff that you know today, like when I first saw it, the movie blew my mind because mm-hmm. I didn't know anything. I was like, this is amazing. You know, this is, and it was such a powerful story. I'm like, yeah, what if? Not that, you know, I live in a tank and, you know, reality is projected on my brain by robots, but like, What if I'm not on the right path, you know, philosophically, or the world is not as it seems to be. It is also the same way as the cave, kind of asking people to be distrustful of their senses.
Well, observing or saying that this is reality and then actual reality is a total another different thing. I mean, that, I guess that's kind of similar with the with Plato's cave.
Somebody says there is no spoon. Sarah says there is no spoon. Yeah, I didn't like that part. What did people think of that? Where the kid bends the spoon? I don't know. Somebody else says Native Interface says later on in the series apparently telekinesis works in the real world too. Not sure if they insinuate that the real world is just another computer simulation, or if it's part of the natural world. Interesting.
It is really confusing.
Does the story, if someone can answer this question in the chat, it would be appreciated. Does the story extend beyond the three movies? Is there more to the, is there a Matrix universe like Star Wars, or is the trilogy all we get?
There were video games.
There were video games. And there is, I know there's the Animatrix, but I've never seen that.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know what that is either. I know it's animated and has to do with the Matrix, but not much more than that. So that was the first thing that we watched last night. I feel like there's more to say about it.
I really enjoyed it. I do. I think we're leaving out some things too. I don't know. I noticed common themes that were kind of disappointing because they're just so like, I mean, there's always there in all these, you know, usually mainstream movies. Like, I mean, well, one thing that was really strange is the kind of love story between Neil and Trinity. I think that was her name.
Mm-hmm.
And that really wasn't there at all. There was a little I guess previews of it, but really it just kind of manifests in one big moment. And then what was really surprising after that, I mean, not surprising, but kind of important, is that he really like was able to kill the agents and also be able to just totally take advantage of all of that and, like, you know, move really cool, stop the bullets, all that kind of stuff. And of course it was kind of like saying, because now he had love, his whole kind of world was changed and he didn't have to do any work at all. This kind of love energy got him and took him out and changed him into this uber kind of man.
Yeah.
And he didn't have to work for it at all, which I just find so disappointing, because it just totally doesn't help you at all in the real life, because that doesn't how it works. I mean, that's not how it works in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of hard work. Not in the just love passages, but that also was in working, like becoming the superhero. He didn't really have to really study or train. Of course they put those discs in his head and he's like, oh, you know, memorize the program,
right?
But all he had to do is, I forget exactly what it was, but it was just like, think you're better. It was kind of like The Secret. And it was just, that was really disappointing too, that there wasn't any hard work, any real effort, any challenge for him to do that.
The other thing too is that obviously the plug going into the back of the head has a dual purpose, right? It can be used to control you, or it can be used to liberate you by giving you all of this information that's useful in the real world. So the plug is representative itself of technology. Like, you know, the old saying at this point, you know, with electricity, you can kill a man or make him dinner, you know? And so we see how technology has gone wrong, as we're seeing a lot of the technology that we love and enjoy and waste so much time with today being used by people in government to spy. There's that duality again.
Yeah.
But the plug goes into the back of the head and it, you know, leaves you in a pile of goo while harnessing your body's energy to power machines that are the enemy of humanity. Or, you know, once it is harnessed by people who want to liberate humanity, it has, you know, all of these wonderful benefits and all of these educational opportunities.
And also something that was really interesting that may go to support your claim that Plato's cave had a lot to do with this movie is the very rationalist anti-census theme in the film. I mean, like, you know, there was Morpheus when he was like, what is reality? And blah, 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 you know, all that kind of stuff. But then also about kind of the Matrix saying, it's like, this is not the real world, even though your senses tell you it's the real world.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of anti-senses.
If you know, if you're just joining us, I don't expect here in 2013 that anyone goes on the internet and says, oh, where can I find a review of the Matrix? You know, I we're not breaking any ground here. This Jeff had never seen the movie before. Rarely do I encounter somebody who's never seen the movie, so we watched it immediately on Blu-ray. Looked beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think I'd ever seen it on anything other than VHS.
Mm-hmm.
I think I watched the last time I saw that movie was on a VHS tape. And it's interesting, too, like back to the technology thing while we're talking about that. You know, the dual use of the technology for control or for liberation, which is pretty much, I think, that you know, there's a saying that used to be on my old website, there is no such thing as a neutral education.
Mm-hmm.
Education is either for domestication, schooling, or liberation, which is actual real education. And this technology that they're talking about is the same way. So when this movie came out, you know, there was no YouTube. The internet was totally different, totally different than it is today. I remember being very excited a year or so after The Matrix came out that I could make my own Yahoo page that I could customize with the weather in my area. Like, you could have a Yahoo homepage. You can probably still do this. I don't know who does. And I can have all my little interests. I could see what are the top movies in the box office. And it was like before Facebook. You could customize. And it was like, oh, my goodness, this is amazing what we can do. But there was no YouTube. There was no Wikipedia. There was really no Web 2.0. You know, mm-hmm. people weren't generating their own content for the internet. Mm-hmm. So there was very little like consumer feedback about like you could go to CNET.com might have existed where you could get like tech reviews, but you couldn't just see like hundreds of user reviews or comments on stuff. So the internet mm-hmm. didn't have the same life. And, you know, there was a lot of great stuff on the internet 14 years ago, but it was nothing like it was today. So the preview, it's almost prophetic, like what they, you know, obviously still, yeah, we can't sit down on the internet and learn Kung Fu in an hour, mm-hmm. but anything else? Have somebody typed in all caps? What do they say?
There is no more movies past the three Matrix ones. There is a David Icke video, The Secret of the Matrix.
Ooh. Yeah. So, okay. So this is where the Matrix, and this is another thing that speaks to some of the themes in the movie. In the last decade, the Matrix also became synonymous with a lot of Fruit Loopy kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of... I told you I used to live in Salem, Massachusetts, yeah. where they're really new agey and like, oh, you know, what if we live in a dream world and none of this
Wiccas,
is real?
Wiccas are prevalent too, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're witches.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of like Salem, Massachusetts, like as their main tourist attraction, Salem Witch Trials. Like, it's not like, oh, here's a beautiful old city with a lot of colonial architecture and a view of the ocean. It's like witches, you know? We killed some people who, and we thought they were witches when we were religious fanatics, rivaling, you know, what goes on in Saudi Arabia today. Mm-hmm. So that's what they chose to make their number one tourist attraction in Salem. It's been a successful choice for them. It's not what I would have picked if I was in charge. So around the witch thing in Salem and Wiccan and witchy and goblins, and it became, you know, this whole new age. Salem is very new agey, right? Mm. There's a lot of like bookstores, like heal yourself with magic crystals, you know, that kind of stuff. These were people who were like, yeah, telekinesis and reality is a dream world. And it's, mm-hmm. There's still talk about this stuff today. And now David Icke is another person who used the Matrix as a metaphor for the world is not what it seems.
Because the world is reptiles.
The truth is, yeah, all the powerful people that you know are, or that you know of in the world, or many of them anyway, are these reptilian shapeshifters.
Mm-hmm.
The Matrix left some things unclear that obviously other people could fit. Like, it's good. It's a great metaphor for libertarians. Stefan Molyneux has used it a lot. He's made some great videos about it. But, you know, a lot of people on the really far left have also, used the Matrix as a metaphor to push their ideology.
Yeah, I think there could be a better metaphor. I think it's definitely interesting. I really enjoyed watching the movie. Mm-hmm. It was definitely like, you know, got me thinking. But I still think there could be a better metaphor because it does seem – I mean, when you say that, you kind of – you reference the movie, and the movie seems to be still basked in, like, authoritarian, like, you know, like kind of mysticism and that kind of stuff.
Right. Now, we also wanted to talk a little bit about this Ayn Rand documentary in Atlas Shrugged, right? Now, this is a movie that – or that's a – it's a movie now, but it was a novel in 1957. Not really open for interpretation.
Yeah.
You know,
mostly documentary. Yeah.
You know, no one is like, yeah, that the Mauch, he's the corporations. No, it's not. It's very cut and dry. It's very clear. It doesn't leave much room for question. And because of that, I teased the show tonight with the question, which had a greater impact on society, The Matrix or Atlas Shrugged?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry. I really think – I'd call if you disagree. Put it in the chat if you disagree. The Matrix was a much more successful because it didn't have a clear philosophy, which meant that it could be engraced by a variety of different ideologies of different groups and used for their purpose. David Icke, witches, communists, libertarians, Atlas Shrugged does not offer that kind of flexibility.
Well, I'm not going to say that either one. I mean, I don't know if either. I mean, I don't know which one I would say, but I've had more of a impact. But what you seem to be clarifying as success is quantity. which I would say quality.
Right.
And I say I would probably go with Atlas Shrugged and Ayn Rand's kind of like resume and her all her books and her philosophy, even though I disagree with some of it, I still think it's pretty awesome, the kind of the virtue of selfishness especially. And so I would think, though, saying that, with quality, I still think with her, she has a very poor quality of her, you know, consumers of her work, because they don't really get what she's about. Like, most of them are still pro-war. Most of them are still religious. She hasn't made them uncomfortable enough. And I'm talking about the far right. I mean, not the far right. The religious right in America. Make them uncomfortable to either change their minds or to not listen to her. And so I kind of find that disappointing.
Right. So the range of Ayn Rand's work as far as who can use it, because it is pervertible, right? It's not like, you know, no one on the left is going to go, oh, yeah, this is totally about how the man is keeping us down.
Yeah.
You know, it's totally about these rich corporate bastards who it's not open to that kind of interpretation. But there are people who embraced Atlas Shrugged as a kind of a blueprint for world domination. You know, like, oh, yeah, I should rule the world because I'm one of these supermen. I mean, it's interesting, too, that Rand was probably somewhat influenced by Friedrich Nietzsche.
Yep.
And his idea that most people are sheep, most people suck, most people are never going to do any – they're never going to be self-actualizing, but you can be. Now, unfortunately, people like Hitler also thought that Nietzsche was talking to them and like, oh, this is how you be self-actualizing. You take charge, you Rand, I think – made that more accessible and like clearer for everybody. All I'm pointing out is that she probably was somewhat influenced by Nietzsche, and Atlas Shrugged could be, you know, another way. And this partly has to do with, the people on the left vilifying Ayn Rand. And that's, this is a how-to guide, how to be an asshole, you know, step-by-step guide to being an asshole and justifying it.
Yeah.
And my understanding of Ayn Rand, from what I've read and what I have seen, was not a terribly pleasant person in her own personal life. But that's not what this work is about.
I mean, I haven't studied Ayn Rand at all, but also she kind of was with the inner circle of, you know, you're only a study, I mean, like a student of objectivism. The fact that she calls her philosophy objectivism is pretty damn arrogant.
Why?
Because they call something, it's like calling truthism or having a truth movement. It's just like, it's like scientists don't say, this is truth or anything like that. I mean, well, I guess they kind of, I mean, they do, but I mean, they label a whole thing objective. It's kind of, it just seems really arrogant, where I would say this is just, you know, Rainian philosophy. This is what she came up with, and she hopes it's objective.
Well, see,
like, you have to verify that through reason, evidence, or the scientific method, et cetera.
Right. Well, I think the name was probably the last thing that she did. It did seem to achieve what philosophy hadn't been able to achieve up to that point. There were great rational philosophers. There were very respectable people from the empiricist school. But objectivism really kind of blended those two in a really coherent way. And I think it could have been maybe this is huge speculation on my part, but she could have been saying, idiots, this is objectivism, because the world was so lacking in that, right? Mm-hmm. Everything was subjective and collectivistic and wishy-washy. I'm trying to think of the time. Like, if we go back to the 1950s, like, America is overrun by nationalism, emerging Christian socialism. So it says at one point in the documentary that we watched that everybody is either a collectivist socialist, a socialist collectivist, or a mystical collectivist, right? So it's either through religion or it's through faith in the government, like mm-hmm. During the New Deal,
yeah.
during Franklin Roosevelt's time. So she sees it going in two directions, both the wrong direction. One, the religious direction, which is why when she criticized that, that's why the right people on the right hate her. And when she criticized socialism, that's why people on the left considered her to be an enemy.
Yeah.
So she couldn't really – she didn't leave – like just to compare it back to The Matrix, didn't leave the same open to interpretation kind of that The Matrix leaves people yeah. with, right? Which is vague. It's not – it doesn't have a coherent philosophy. It's not articulate. Morpheus doesn't give a 60-page long speech – in The Matrix, like John Galt does, that lays everything out in a completely clear and unquestionable way. Now, people can twist Ayn Rand to their own nefarious purposes, mm-hmm. but The Matrix, it's much easier to just make it fit into whatever you want, I think.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, judging something's success, especially philosophy-wise, I think a lot of documents, philosophical documents, have been very, very popular. And, I mean... maybe not. I mean, not everybody knows of them, but they might just know of it. And maybe people who've done a little research might know a little bit more about it. But I think there's definitely more power, more success in making something quality and making irrational people, even evil people, nervous about it and uncomfortable by it. And so maybe it's not that successful, like, you know, 7 million copies sold. I think that's what the current number for Atlas Shrugged is. But it does get, I guess, a core more knowledgeable and correct group of people about this stuff.
Well, the other thing, too, is that when I was questioning the impact that the book had, you mentioned the number of copies that it was sold. She talks about, in this documentary that we saw, talked about the books that she wrote before that, mm-hmm. which was The Fountainhead was probably the biggest, but there also We the Living, Anthem, which was, I think, maybe one of her first books, which is very short, very easy to read, and very, very explicit mm-hmm. as to what it's talking about in the whole individualism versus collectivism thing. But We the Living deals with that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And she was frustrated with the public perception. Like, why don't people get what I'm saying
yeah.
in We the Living? And then having the same experience with The Fountainhead and then really, really trying to be extra explicit in Atlas Shrugged. So, like, people are not going to read this and say, like they did with The Fountainhead, oh, this is an interesting book about architecture. You know, like, so the Fountainhead, and that was the last book that she wrote, Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah.
Because it accomplished everything. I think that's she won.
Last novel she wrote.
Yeah, she wrote a lot of books after that,
yeah.
but it was the last novel that she wrote, the last fiction work that she wrote.
And also, I mean, one thing about Ayn Rand is that sadly that maybe she couldn't really make that impact of how different she is. And I mean, yeah, she did say a lot that was, you know, totally different from what was gone. And I mean, May came to a lot of conclusions that weren't there before, and that was really different. But that being so different wasn't able to have its full impact, I feel, especially in her political philosophy. Because I don't know much if she said that God is not just – I don't know if she took the agnostic position or the true atheist position.
She was very, very much an atheist.
Oh, okay. Like, there is no God.
I think all the atheists –
there is no supernatural.
Yeah, all the left-wing Richard Dawkins, Bill Maher types who shit on her today actually owe her a lot
yeah.
for how mainstream atheism is.
Yeah.
Today.
Well, I mean, also, like, with her political philosophy, the fact that she didn't go all the way to anarchism and stayed at minarchism is really disappointing. And also, because, I mean, she wasn't able to really differentiate herself from the founding fathers, from, like, other minarchist kind of ideologies, which just makes her basically the same of the old and not really change that much. I mean, even though I felt like there's a lot there that she did change, that wasn't able to see its full potential because of that.
Because
of that
she
shortfalling.
Didn't apply that consistently.
Yeah, to anarchism.
Right. And yeah, that's basically been a lot of libertarians, even people who really respect Ayn Rand, would certainly agree with you on that she didn't take it all the way. And, one of her – the guy who's considered the – basically the intellectual heir to the Ayn Rand, you know, the whole Ayn Rand philosophy is Leonard Peikoff, who is a super pro-war. I could show you a video of him on the O'Reilly Factor. Now, O'Reilly is like a real pro-war hawk kind of guy, mm-hmm. especially when George Bush was president. And he's like trying to calm Leonard Peikoff down. Leonard Peikoff is like the head of the Ayn Rand Institute or something in that ballpark. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, we should bomb the whole Middle East to glass. We should kill them all. And the term that they used was national self-interest, which totally, like, I understand self-interest in acting in your own self-interest, but now, this was the most important message one of the most important messages in all of objectivism, mm-hmm. is that if you don't act in your own, if you don't prioritize your own rational self-interest and you let yourself be subsumed by the collective, right? Well, powerful people who are like, we are going to free ourselves, you know, as individuals from the pitfalls of selfishness by prioritizing the collective, the community, the nation over ourselves. Mm-hmm. But the person who always sets what is the priority for the collective are always selfish, narcissistic, and predatory people mm-hmm. who are manipulating the masses into thinking this is in our best interest. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly what had been done in 2003 or 2004 when Leonard Peikoff is accepting George Bush's definition, one of those people, or at least a puppet of those predatory people who are selfish and acting in their own specific interest at the expense of almost everybody else, to use this term national self-interest as if it was individual. Mm-hmm. So that was like, okay, well, as far as objectivism is concerned, is something that I would call myself, I'm out.
Yeah.
That's not a label that I want.
What about Greenspan and all that kind of stuff? I mean, there's been a lot of people who've totally changed almost totally what Ayn Rand was about. And at least they say they were followers of her, but really don't follow at all of what she said. Well, not all, some of it. And I think that kind of says not just abstract how her philosophy was kind of vague in some areas and what didn't really attack some things as strong, at least from my amateur experience with it. I guess nationalism, like kind of different types of nationalism and also kind of a war and that kind of stuff. And it's kind of not just abstract but also – socially, how that kind of was a vague, how, you know, he would go on a show that was with right wingers and that kind of stuff, like how Greenspan would interact with, the actual controller of the Fed, and how there wasn't that like kind of, these people are totally radical, we can't interact with them, which is a good thing for the most part, because most people aren't rational people and aren't going to, you know, maybe come around to that. So I think maybe that's a badge to wear that they didn't sadly wear because they didn't make them uncomfortable enough.
Right. And I the other thing, too, is that this might have just gotten watered down over time.
Yeah.
Like Ayn Rand was opposed to nationalism, right, which is very mystical and very collectivist.
Yeah.
So especially when you look at her roots and her personally escaping, you know, revolutionary Russia mm-hmm. in the 1920s and Stalinism, you know, and her family's – I think her father was a pharmacist.
Yeah.
It said. And so, you know, his business is taken over by the state for the good of the people. Mm-hmm. I really agreed with the documentary about how prophetic the film was. The book Atlas Shrugged was written in the 1950s, but I think you could see all of the seeds not only just planted then, but, you know, sprouting and growing. You had nationalism. You had had the Woodrow Wilson administration. You had had the New Deal. You'd have this collectivist infiltration of America that had been going on throughout most of the 20th century from European intellectuals that I've been talking about on other shows recently. So like for somebody who was sensitive to that and somebody who had experienced that coming to fruition in Russia, she was definitely on a vigilant lookout for that and could see it in America where most people couldn't, right? Like if you ask a German who lived through the Nazis about America today, they're like, yep, this is how it happens. But people who are living through it for the first time can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So Ayn Rand had an awareness in the 1940s and 50s that most people in America didn't have.
Well, I mean, talking about Ayn Rand and philosophical movements and philosophical ideas, I mean, it just brings to mind, I really don't think, I mean, at least from my amateur opinion, that really any philosophical movement has had really that much of an impact on society. And I know that, I mean, I know the Enlightenment Age and how they moved to democracy and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But still, have we reached anything, really that much different? And if there is change, how much change has it been? Because it seems like it's been very, very small.
Well, I think that, you know, we could talk about people who are influential or movements that they started that were influential. Like I think we established that Plato is influential. And this allegory of the cave thing is replicating all throughout time in every different place conceivable. It's happening to Ayn Rand in the 1950s because, you know, she comes and says, oh, well, wait till you see the real world. You know, if you think this Christianity or this, you know, more extreme dogmatic form of the followership of Jesus or, you know, any kind of religious mysticism or your nationalism or your socialism, wait till you see like reality. Let me show you reality and clarity. And people said, not interested. Sorry, we're not buying your book. And frankly, your book sucks. You know, the characters are unrealistic. It's way too long. You got a guy giving a 60-page speech. The editors wanted her to cut that part out entirely. You know, the part of the book that she worked on for 2 years.
Yeah.
The Galt's speech. They said, it's not really necessary. He says all that stuff at other places in the book. Do you remember what it was called? The Prophecy of Ayn Rand or the Ayn Rand Prophecy, something like that. If you Google Ayn Rand and Prophecy.
No, the Prophecy of Atlas Shrugged.
The Prophecy of Atlas Shrugged. So you Google Atlas Shrugged and Prophecy and you'll find this documentary. We watched it on Netflix.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I highly recommend it if you've been, you know, immersed in this world for years, you might not gain much from it. I wouldn't recommend it to my friend Wes, right? Like, yeah, I don't think there's anything in there that he doesn't know. But if you want to learn more about the story behind that novel and, you know, the struggle that Ayn Rand had trying to alert the United States to the path it was collectively or, you know, citizens of the United States were collectively on, this was a worthwhile use of a couple hours.
Yeah, so. I think it'd be really interesting exploring, like, why – I mean – not just Ayn Rand, but other philosophical movements, and if they failed or succeeded, and if they failed, why they failed, and if they succeeded, why they succeeded.
Well, philosophical movements, I think, and you know, this is my opinion, they succeed if they're easy. You know, a bad philosophy, or in other words, a successful ideology will succeed if it offers, you know, simplistic ideas for lazy minds. So communism and socialism are, people love it because, it's like saying, like, if we had a problem, right? The easiest thing for me to do if I'm having a problem with somebody else is to say, well, you know, you'll either do what I want or I'm terribly afraid I'm going to do something violent to you. Mm-hmm. So you will agree with me or violence will happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the state and that's socialism, right? So instead of saying, like, how can we solve a problem, being, consistent with the values that we teach our children, don't hurt people, don't steal, tell the truth. Right? How can we solve large-scale social problems and be consistent with those values and not grant a tiny little minority of people exemption mm-hmm. from those values so they can do violence and they can do theft and they can deceive in order for our common good, mm-hmm. right? So instead of actually really, you know, putting the nose to the grindstone and saying we got to come up with a solution that adheres to our values but is obviously workable in a large social context, but we can't use violence, right? Because it's always the most troubled and least intelligent people who threaten violence when there's some kind of social conflict.
Yeah.
So, but that's what the state is. It's mm-hmm. the threat of violence in a social conflict.
Mm.
So socialism is like, government will do it. It's the laziest idea possible. It's mm-hmm. the laziest idea possible.
Well, I think you're quite right with that. I mean, most I guess, successful philosophical movements are vain and meaningless. But what I mean by success is actual improvement.
Okay, then strike socialism.
The philosophical mind of at least a majority, I mean, not a majority, but a decent group of people. And not necessarily, it could be a small amount of people, but they're growing, actually growing, having a direct change. Because it seems to me that, like, improvement in humanity has somewhat been in spite of philosophers. I mean, it seems like they've been doing the opposite. And I think that is such a crime because philosophy is so amazing and is so great deciphering the great illusions that are put on by culture. And like, but yet there really hasn't been any real successful philosophical movement that's changed crap.
Okay, well, then we have to kind of define what our standards are for success. Mm-hmm. How many people does it have to be successful for?
Well, no, I guess having it could start from a very small amount of people, but having a incremental change, growth and actual change, not becoming meaningless and vain and just accepting anybody, but really staying core to its actual ideals.
Not becoming watered down.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And how do you do that if you're going to write a book, if you're going to present these ideas to anybody, if you're going to be taking these ideas, how do you not be, become vague or watered down or allow other people to twist it around?
Okay, well, wouldn't you say that Free Domain Radio is successful by those standards?
I think so, but yet with Free Domain Radio, I mean, like Stephanie has even said, there's only a 5% that really, truly, like, get it spot on and understand everything, not just a little part of it. And which is, like, how do you increase that 5%?
So he's saying he thinks or he said something like only a small percentage of everybody. Like if I get 20,000 views on YouTube, it's only a very small number of those people who actually understand.
Not understand. Maybe they might understand anarchism. They might understand the atheism. They might understand the psychology part. But understanding as the full package. I think that's what he meant.
Right. I don't know if he could have higher expectations than that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we always should be looking to improve those numbers.
Sure,
sure.
That's a great question. But I think that he has been successful by the standards that you set. Now, sure, he needs to reach a lot more people. And
well, I don't know if he needs to reach more people. I would think maybe it goes. I mean, it should be maybe looked at just making the people it already has, or trying to get a more, you know, like the full package kind of people, more permanent kind of thing, and focus on those people instead of a bigger audience.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a difficult question to answer because it's
let's solve the world's problems 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So, but what, when I say he needs to reach more people, I mean he reached me, him and another a group of a very small group of people, including Wes and Bertrand and a few others,
mm-hmm.
really helped me.
Mm-hmm.
So my life is better. You know, and that's kind of what I focus on. But I have always, it really, that need for efficacy, especially when you have this, interest in teaching people.
Mm-hmm.
Like I get great pleasure from talking and having people listen to me. And mm-hmm. maybe there's some vanity in that, but I really liked teaching. I really liked the look on kids' faces when you can see and you can experience somebody else being introduced to something new and exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It's very invigorating, and it's a feeling that you can have again and again and again that it's hard to have when you're doing a podcast.
Yeah.
Right? 'Cause, you know, you record it and you say, that was pretty good. And then you put it out and you go, oh, I hope people have that experience.
Yeah.
You looked at the chat. What did it say?
It said 105 is the tipping point, 10%. Are you referring to like the 5% I was talking for? And it's actually 10%?
I think so.
What's the 105?
105. There's a book it's not up here. It's probably downstairs. It's called The Tipping Point. And it said I think it has something to do with the size of groups and when.
Oh, I think like when 5% of the population believes in a certain idea, it's like it's gonna like destined to grow to the rest of the population. I think that's a theory. I'm not exactly sure.
Possibly, but I mean the truth is, and you can see evidence of this in history. When there was major revolutionary change, it was brought about by a minority. And even when the government is slowed, I mean, the government is huge and powerful, and most people are like, "Yeah, government, go." It's a small, very vocal minority that retards their quote unquote progress, which is not progress, but that's what they call it. And you know, even something like the American Revolution, you're talking 10-15% of people were supportive of that.
But what do you mean by revolutionary success? Do you mean communist revolution, you know, the American Revolution? Like, those were changes, and they definitely changed stuff, but it's the same old crap. It's the same old kind of really lousy philosophy. And so I think we can't really look at what most people have already done with kind of saying that that's what could happen too, because what we're doing, what we're promoting, is totally different.
Right. Yeah. And we haven't seen that yet. And
I think it's also a scary notion to realize that we're in totally uncharted territory, and we have to figure out how to spread this like the best possible. And it's not really put out for us already.
Yeah. And I think, you know, prior to the body of work that, you know, Steph produced, that Ayn Rand's objectivism, with all the bad, and I understand a lot of bad stuff comes with it, you know, and a lot of undesirable personalities are attached to it. And it is, you know, it's not as ideologically flexible, like I said before, as The Matrix, but it is pervertible.
Yeah.
To, you know, kind of selfishness as non-benevolence, right? Like, it's okay to be selfish, but not in a malicious way.
Yeah.
Like, not in a way that deliberately hurts other people. And no one is talking about, there's a difference between self-interest and malevolence. Like, and just because you prioritize your life and your purpose over, you know, these other concerns like the state or the church or the whatever they tell you.
Well, Sarah was talking about, and it's actually the book's 10% is the tipping point. I guess it's not 5%, it's 10% of the total population, then it's like destined, or it's really likely that will take over the, you know, whole population. But also Sarah said, Ayn Rand, like Ron Paul, can be a gateway. And yes, I agree with that. I mean, I came through kind of, with Ron Paul helping me very briefly, but he did help me along. But I think for me, that was more of another hurdle to overcome, other than someone who really got me all the way there. And so I think, he did bring up, I mean, a lot of people came through Ron Paul and then became an ANCAP and even went into the peaceful parenting, all that kind of wonderful stuff. But that still is a minority of the Ron Paul population, and I think it's worth looking into finding a more direct, more effective method of doing that. Because like with economics, the main thing is what you don't see, not what you do see.
The other part of it, too, is that we live in a world that is very different from the world of 1957, where time – I mean, obviously, humans have always had an awareness of time. And, you know, time was more important in 1957 than it was in 1757, right? But in 2013, time is precious. And there's a lot – there's never been more stimuli competing for your time and attention as there is right now. So – Ayn Rand, I think, would be incredibly would face even greater challenges in today's world. Like, oh, all you have to do is read a 1,200-page book, and you'll be, you know, you'll be liberated. Your life will be changed. And even Steph has what, 2,500 podcasts, that give a complete picture. So I'm excited about his documentary. Will the documentary distill that? Will it be that revolutionary force in a person's life in an hour and a half?
Yeah.
Because Steph has been that for a lot of people. And there's others. I mean, I know I keep using Steph as an example, but there have been others who have been able to do that. But can they do it in an hour and a half?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think it might even be longer than that. I don't know. Did you say the time?
Of the documentary? Yeah. Something like that.
Well, I think he's planning on doing it three, like the Zeitgeist, but anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but it would take me quite some time to read a 1,200-page book. Again, and it did. You know, anytime I've read a book that long, it took a while. Yeah. It was, you know, I had The Fountainhead on my nightstand, I think, for like 6 months, just slowly, you know.
I've read 200 pages of it in the last 2 weeks, so I beat you.
Yeah, you probably did, because it took me a very, very long time to read. Almost like, you know, where if I had read it in a shorter amount of time, I probably would have gotten more out of it than I did.
Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think if you, I mean, that's even true with like a TV show. Like,
I was just about to say, I was like, well, it doesn't really matter who reads the fastest, who gets, you know, understands most of it. But mm-hmm. I guess that is true, because as long as you keep your mind into it, you might still be focused on it and be more, I don't know. I guess, yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, the other thing too, as far as the gateway is concerned, anybody can be a gateway, you know? David Icke could be a gateway for somebody. But then it speaks to what you're saying too, is like, you know, how much stuff do I have to shake off that I picked up? You know, how much of this debris that I got on me from going through this whole political thing do I now have to cleanse myself of before I can move on? So if it was somebody like David Icke, yeah, you've got a lot of crap on you that you have to clean off before you can really go forward. But the door might be open where you say, oh, well, the world is different. Let's investigate.
And just because you come to, you know, philosophy or something through a certain event or, you know, someone, that doesn't make it sure. Like, I mean, let's say you discover all this stuff from the inception of hating public school. Mm-hmm. It's just like, well, okay, that's good, but you shouldn't be sent to public school. That's not a good idea. That's not going to help you. I mean, for the large amount, that's not going to inspire people to really go down through, like, you know, rational, empirical philosophy. And so I think that you should really look at what's the best, most effective, direct way.
One of the best ways to have a major impact on people in a short amount of time is through art, you know? Mm-hmm. So you have to, obviously, it is very, very difficult to reinvigorate in some people the lost curiosity.
By art, do you just mean media in general? Or
I just mean film, just art? Books. Oh, okay. You know.
I mean, podcasts are not. Do you include that or
no? And podcasts, okay. I would call media. Podcasts, not really art. But I would say, you know, the medium that I think could have the most significant impact on the largest number of people in a very short amount of time would be a movie. You know? And I think that even When you move into the documentary genre, you start to create limitations for yourself. Because when somebody is introduced to something that is a documentary, I think the guard goes up a little bit, where to the person who wants to maintain their own status quo, they say, okay, documentary. This is a person who wants to tell me something. Mm. They have a point of view. Okay, you know, I know what I'm, and I'm not saying we should try to like bamboozle people into accepting these ideas, but also it's hard to be sincere in a documentary and still be able to reach people on the emotional level that you need to reach people to inspire them to learn or to change or to take action, whatever you're trying to inspire them to do. Like, Michael Moore is great at using all kinds of emotional trickery to inspire you to write a letter to your shitty congressman.
Yeah.
You know, about, you know, pass universal health care.
Yeah.
More regulations for corporations. But obviously that's first of all, it's an insincere approach to communicating a message. Mm-hmm. And it's not a good solution.
Yeah.
So I think that medium is very powerful. But I've never really seen anything done in film that – I mean, The Matrix is probably
– So you mean a movie, a fictional movie that explains philosophical ideas or has a philosophical undertone?
Yeah. The Matrix was the best opportunity. I think they missed the opportunity, though, to present a coherent philosophy. And it might just be because – you know, I don't know. Maybe the guys who made that movie, I don't know too much. I mean, obviously there's this strong anti-authoritarian vein in that movie. But yeah, that's true. I mean, we talked about that too, that there is a new authority that presents itself as soon as, like, Neo is liberated from the old authority. So.
Oh, wait. Someone commented, how can students defuse the educational bomb?
How can students defuse the educational bomb?
Huh, that's a pretty interesting topic. He also had some comments about the movie. I mean, our movie subject. I was saying it should be, it has to, would have to be literal, not metaphor. Which I don't know. I think the power, I mean, for it to be a film, not a documentary, it would thus be, would thus be metaphor. I mean, if it was literal, wouldn't that be a documentary? I mean,
yeah. Here's what I would say to that. You can get away with a lot more if you're not being direct. And the thing is that there are some people who you're just not going to reach. And you know, it's, I think that's fine when you consider that it doesn't take a majority of people. So we need to free ourselves from the ideas of, you know, as far as change is concerned, from the democratic idea that, yeah, I mean, if you want a voluntary society, everybody would need to accept it. But most people, if 10% of people accepted it, 60% of people would go along with it. And that, you know, yeah, I'm picking those numbers arbitrarily, but you know, 10% of people are change agents. 60% of people are followers. Everybody else is just a you know, a guard of the status quo. So I don't think it really needs to be. Obviously, yes, to live in a voluntary world, everyone needs to accept that voluntarily.
Well, at least no, not everyone, because there can be criminals, and that can be dealt with.
Sure, sure.
So I guess just a, you know, the due point of, you know, people needs to be there until it bursts into a voluntary society, and it will probably stay there.
Right. But I mean, when we're talking about measurements of success, I really believe that people should use their own lives and their own experiences. And, you know, it can be frustrating to beat yourself up about the lack of your lack of impact on the world. And this is what I talked about. I mean, I talked about this in the podcast a lot, but if you discover libertarianism and your first action is to end the Federal Reserve, you're going to get frustrated pretty quickly and give up, right? Because you don't start a new pursuit like that by trying to take on one of the most powerful organizations in the world, because it's disempowering and it's frustrating. And it leads to – I mean, this is why so many people, you know, speaking to what Jeff mentioned earlier, so many people got into Ron Paul, burned out and disappeared.
Yep.
So one of the goals of people that I know here in the Free State Project was retention. To like, okay, yeah, Ron Paul's gone. You know, that's it. What do you do now? Where do you go now? And trying to draw people into, you know, the Free State through reaching out to people who were involved with Ron Paul, who were maybe more a part of the cult of personality or the novelty, the political novelty of Ron Paul. But okay, yeah, Ron Paul's gone. Ron Paul wasn't successful. So now what do you do? Where do you go?
Yeah,
who else is continuing these ideas?
Yeah, I think that goes with the theme of quality too, not quantity. I think that's a really important thing to do is retention.
Yeah, so you know, that was the thing. A lot of people were just so I get angry about political action and the Fed stuff because that pushes people away.
Yeah,
you know, not because it's unappealing to, you know, end political corruption or end the Federal Reserve. Like, those are appealing ideas, but they're impossible in the short term.
What I really hate those for is the fact, I mean, that they haven't really been shown the work. There hasn't been really any success in them. And the people yet continue to say they are and claim to know so much about the free market, yet they just keep doing the same thing over and over again, like a government institution.
Mm-hmm.
And to have that contradiction is just like, yeah, I'm not going to respect you because you contradict yourself. And I mean, I don't want to be like, oh, you know, you suck. I don't want to be anything like that. I mean, but it is a form of, you know, being a hypocrite. And I'm not saying like they're bad, but it's just like people get a sense of that when you're talking to them about this, maybe at a conscious level or an unconscious level, and they'll be turned off by it because of that.
Right. Absolutely. So where else can we go? Any?
How about the educational bomb? I mean, just like talking about how, if you're a student, how to learn on your off time, how to pursue your interests, how to develop those skills. Or if you are totally out of school, you're a college graduate, you're an unschooler, whatever, how to learn your skills. Or if you're an adult and you want to do it on your off time from your work.
How exactly did they phrase the question?
I think there's a little higher, but it's like, how can a student defuse the educational bomb? And I'm presuming the educational bomb is the crap that's thrown on you through public school. I'm not exactly sure. If you would like to clarify that, please do so.
843, join SSP. The question is, how can students defuse the education bomb? But I'm not sure what the education bomb is.
Yeah.
This person has a lot to say.
Yeah.
That person should call 843, join SSP, Skype in, School Sucks Live, or clarify if none of those things are possible, clarify in the chat.
I think he did.
Learning fallacies?
Or learning of fallacies?
Or kind of like school learning, which is training.
So he means, how a different way of learning from that?
I really don't know what
keeping
they mean.
Keeping themselves interested in learning. Oh, okay. That's... He says keeping themselves interested in learning. So, I mean, I guess what I would say to that is, do some, self-exploration. Really look at what you are interested in and what is learning for you. I mean, is learning anything valuable or something that's actually a valid interest for yourself? So I think really discovering what those interests are, because they're not really facilitated at all. You're not really forced to – I mean, not forced, but – push to discover them at all, because in school you don't really have any choice. You don't really have any ability to pursue your interests.
Right. Yeah. And I think it really has to do with keeping your guard up and encouraging people around you. Because like, if you're asking a question like that, your guard is already up. You're already kind of like hip to what's going on. So, you have to encourage other people to do that and to ask questions and try to reinvigorate that curiosity that's been crushed by school. And you have to understand what's going on in school, that school is a game that people school can become, or it's not, school is not a game, but school can become, as Osborne has said on this show so many times in the past, a game that people play once they understand it. Like, if you do good in school, maybe it creates more opportunities for you. And my dad, my dad was the chairman of the school board in the town where I went to elementary school and was very interested in education. And he said, Brett, school is not fun. Most of the people who are your teachers are shitheads. But the better you do there, the more opportunities it creates for you. And what we're really trying to do in the 21st century is to change that paradigm, where success in school is less important for where we can go next, right? Because it still is a challenge to get into college or to be successful without college. People are still very much being herded into those traditional channels and given very sort of old and stale definitions of success. So what we're trying to do is alert people to, a changing world in which we live and new opportunities that are becoming available. Hmm. And I think that if you're trying to diffuse, if the bomb is a weapon that hurts people and you're trying to diffuse it, to go back to that first question, helping raise people's awareness and not doing it in a judgmental or critical way, because that will just push people away. These are lessons that I had to learn the hard way. Going up to people and saying, or something that comes across to them as, do you want to know how stupid you are? People will not be lining up to have interactions with you. So encouraging people to ask questions and also even when questions are a threat to authority. So the more questions you present about what's going on in school, why the school works the way it does, what's being taught, those questions will be perceived by authorities as threats. And you have to be, diplomatic and careful about how you even approach that with those people, right? You don't want to be belligerent. You don't want to be overly oppositional. I like the gadfly approach that Socrates, I guess, introduced, right? Where you're just a curious fella or gal. You've got questions.
Mm.
You want answers. Why? You know, and without being, a kind of a passive aggressive about it too. It's a delicate balance, but the sooner people start practicing that and the sooner people are encouraged to do that, closer I think you are to witnessing meaningful change, at least in your immediate environment.
And also, be the change, don't be the same. If you want like a better society, embody that. And he also added, when I love the subject, I would ace the test. But if I did not like the subject, I did poorly. I think that makes perfect sense. And I think you're a human being. Of course, if you don't like the subject, you shouldn't be forced to have to learn about it. And if you really like a subject and you want to learn more about it, school's not going to teach you more about it. Try to find out other, ventures that you can learn about it in real ways. Like if there's a local business, if you're really into science and there's a local laboratory, try to find out if you can intern with the guy. Try to find out if you can, somehow get in there, use their equipment. Just try to really explore all these possibilities. Put on a bright smile and be really polite and be really, earnest and honest, and opportunities will open up.
It is in your self-interest to have pleasant interactions with other people.
So I thought that was a nice place to end our conversation. Like I said, there is more to it. It is available in the AV Club, and I encourage you to join, support the show, and check out some of the extra offerings that are available there. All right, I will talk to you again soon. Thanks for listening to the show, everyone. Have a great day.